The state of Victoria is in the public gaze at the moment for all the wrong reasons. The border between New South Wales and Victoria closes tonight at midnight. Authorities have placed several hotspot postcodes in Melbourne back into stage 3 coronavirus lockdown. These restrictions are being enforced by police patrols and random checks. People moving in and out of those suburbs are being asked by police to identify themselves and provide a valid reason for being outside. Meanwhile, residents of 9 public housing towers in these areas face additional restrictions. Yesterday on the show, we heard from 21-year-old Heba Shanino, a university student who lives in one of those 9 towers. She's lived there all her life. Here's what Heba had to say about the sudden nature of the lockdown.
It was effective immediately, as we heard on the news from Daniel Andrews, and it was something that we didn't have time to prepare for. We had no time to even mentally or physically prepare for. So it put a strain on our community in every aspect.
Heba Shanino, one of those residents affected in those public housing towers. She spoke to us on Life Matters yesterday. And this current situation may raise some important questions for you regarding what measures a government should take in the interests of public health when potentially those measures might infringe on a person's democratic human rights. It's a tough question and there's no easy answers, but I'd like to really hear your thinking on this. You can leave your comments on our Facebook page. Just search for RN Life Matters. With me, two guests. Stan Winford is the Associate Director of the Centre for Innovative Justice at RMIT University, and also Dr. Maria O'Sullivan, who's a Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Law at Monash University. Welcome to you both. And Maria, I might start with you, if you don't mind. Over the weekend, we saw these 9 public housing towers in Melbourne put under a hard lockdown, beginning on Saturday afternoon, with an hour's notice, while stay-at-home orders for other residents in nearby suburbs were from midnight that night. What do you make of the differentiation in approach?
Well, Michael, I think we need to talk about two things, the law and the optics. So the law is quite clear. Under the Public Health Act, they have fairly wide powers. So, for example, there can be orders for a particular group of people or a particular section of the community. So it is actually within the law for a determination to be made which focuses on one particular building. So that's what's lawfully permitted. Then we have to turn to the charter so we've got a Victorian charter. Obviously, not all states in Australia do, but in the Victorian situation, we would then have to look at whether the freedom of movement is necessary and proportionate, so that restriction on freedom of movement. But in terms of differentiation, that's legally allowable. Now turning to the optics, I did think that there were, you know, there was some talk on Twitter, for example, that, you know, this wouldn't happen in Toorak. So there's a belief amongst some that that would not have been done had it not been for a housing commission estate. But that, you know, that really goes to the optics, to the fact that perhaps I think better notification should have been given to the people in that estate. But I think here we have to differentiate between the law and the policy of the action.
It's interesting to think about this too in other terms, because I think it was the Deputy Chief Medical Officer of the Commonwealth who described these towers akin to vertical cruise ships. And of course, when you think about cruise ships arriving back in this country, those passengers were treated very differently to the rest of the population at that time of coronavirus control. So there is a differentiation there, and it's not like it hasn't happened before, is what I'm saying.
Yes, exactly. And perhaps we've learnt from what happened with the cruise ships in New South Wales, the fact that they were let go and went to other states. So, but yeah, in terms of a hard lockdown, I guess the public health argument is that it's necessary because of the cramped conditions and the fact that there's only 2 lifts, etc. And as I said, people would probably be surprised if they were to read the Public Health Act, and I was quite shocked at the wide discretion that is given to health authorities to make these determinations.
Are you at all concerned that keeping people indoors, inside their apartments, could impinge on their human rights?
Yes, and the most the clearest example of that is freedom of movement. The only thing is that freedom of movement is a derogable right, so it can be limited. In comparison, the prohibition against torture and ill treatment is a non-derogable right, so you know we can't limit that. But if we look at, say, freedom of movement, it is allowable to limit that, but we have to show that it's necessary. And, of course, the health authorities here would be saying it's necessary in relation to the estates because of the health evidence. And then secondly, you'd have to look at whether it's proportionate. Now, there might be an argument there that a hard lockdown in the way that's being done now, maybe, you know, if we look at the access to fresh air, the fact that people can't exercise, they can't leave to go and get groceries, then I think there might be an argument about proportionality, but I think it's clearly necessary.
Have we ever seen people detained like this before? Are there precedents in other parts of our history?
Not to my knowledge. Of course, there have been more individualised determinations in relation to people with tuberculosis. And in fact, there's been two cases over the last 10 years where tuberculosis patients have refused treatment and they were detained. One was detained at home and then one was detained in a facility to undergo treatment. But that's a fairly extreme example. But on a group basis, to my knowledge, this has not been done, particularly in modern history at least.
I might bring in Stan now. Stan Winford is the Associate Director for the Centre for Innovative Justice at RMIT University. Stan, are you in concurrence with Maria's take on what's happened in Victoria?
Yeah, look, I agree with that. I think the point that she's making about the optics of this is really interesting too, because one of the things that people have talked about in relation to the hard lockdown of the towers has been the way in which it was conducted and the perception of, you know, people, residents in those towers seeing police rather than health workers as the front-facing image that they had of what was going on. And I think that's really significant because the way in which people view the legitimacy of laws and actions has a lot to do with the process and whether the process is perceived as fair. So I think there's a lot that we could learn about how to do these things in a way that, you know, achieves the outcome by, you know, building trust in the process and perceptions of legitimacy.
So, Stan, if there may be some trust lost in the way the towers situation was managed, does that mean there could be issues around compliance as well?
Yeah, look, the empirical evidence is that people comply with the law not because they're afraid of punishment, but because they believe it's legitimate. And most behavioural researchers and lawyers who are interested in this area of theory recognise that the best way to achieve compliance with the law is through, you know, similar to human rights, treating people with dignity and respect, enabling them to participate in decisions that affect them in a meaningful way, communicating those decisions with clarity so that people know what the rules mean and that they seem to make sense. So when you kind of impose something like this with very little notice on people who may have less access to, you know, information about what's going on and you don't back it up with information and the right messages about supporting people and the role that they're playing, then you do run a risk that people are not going to comply with it, or at least that they will feel that they're being treated very badly by these laws.
Maria O'Sullivan, a question without notice, if I may, from a text. This is from Jen, who says, the question has to be, why were they not given, this is the tower residents, not given 24 hours notice, and then why wasn't the organisation for them in place first? She says, we live in Ascot Vale, which is another suburb of Melbourne, and I think one of the hotspot areas, and Jen says they got plenty of notice. Maria, would you like to comment on that?
I guess from a human rights point of view, again, if we look at whether it was necessary, I mean, I'm not attuned to all the internal government thinking on this, but my understanding is that they did feel that a very quick response was necessary because of the high numbers of COVID cases in the estates. So I guess in that regard, they didn't feel that they could give 24 ideal world, I think that would have been a good thing to do. So I can't really speak to, I guess, the government decision making. I do think that the evidence is quite clear that they felt that a very quick response was necessary. So all I can really say to that is that, yeah, in the human rights sphere, we would look at whether it was necessary and then, again, whether it was proportionate. If I just mention also something called the rule of law, getting away from human rights for a moment.
Sure.
The rule of law is a principle which talks about consistency, predictability, and so forth. And this is an accepted principle coming.
Marie, are you there?
In the UK. And this is the problem when we're dealing with a health situation. We can't have that predictability and certainty of the law. It's very much in flux, and I think that really goes to the question in the text. Unfortunately, we are in a pandemic situation, so some of these normal rules go out the window.
Is that because we're under an emergency situation, and therefore there's different powers that come into play?
Yes, and there is a formal declaration as to a state of emergency in all the states and territories, and that does allow these limitations on human rights, and it does allow differentiation amongst residents and suburbs.
Stan Winford, we've seen states go into lockdown at a border level. We now have New South Wales closing its border to Victoria at midnight tonight. And yet we haven't seen lockdowns to this degree before, I think for at least a century, much less on a postcode level. What are some of the challenges here when it comes to individual rights versus the great sense of need to contain this virus for public health reasons?
Well, that's right. The border will be closed at 12:01 a.m. tonight for the first time in 100 years. Last time that happened was during the Spanish flu, and quarantine camps were established and restrictions were placed on movement. The way it's happening legally is that it's been based on a declaration under New South Wales law that Melbourne effectively is a place for which people can't visit New South Wales.
But I think, if I may interrupt, that New South Wales declaration came in concert with Victoria agreeing that this needed to occur, correct?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
And there's been questions raised during discussions earlier about whether Queensland should open its borders, about whether it's constitutionally possible, because there are a couple of provisions in the Constitution, sections 92 and 117, that prevent discrimination against people based on which state they live in, or that enable freedom of interstate trade and commerce and movement within the Federation. But there's plenty of authority to suggest that they can be limited in circumstances such as these. So, there's been cases where all sorts of impositions have been imposed on people's freedom during wartime. We've had curfews, we've had, nightclubs being closed because loose lips sink ships.
That's right, and blackouts as well, of course, so there's no lighting observable from the air.
That's right. So I think the government has very broad powers to do things when there is a state of emergency, whether it's a health emergency, an emergency that relates to transmission of infectious diseases, or whether it relates to security. I think the question is probably, much like human rights, is the purpose for which these restrictions on our movement or our liberty are imposed, are they necessary? Are they proportionate? Are they reasonably adapted to, the problem that's trying to be solved? So in some of those earlier examples during wartime, for example, one of the Premier of New South Wales tried to shut all the nightclubs because he said that, all sorts of seditious activity could be going on and people could be spilling state secrets. But the Supreme Court said, look, we don't think so. I don't think there's really any evidence that closing nightclubs will save us from that sort of problem. So you've got it.
I think that's hilarious. Can I say, who thought that nightclubs would be the place where state secrets would be transferred, particularly if the music's quite loud? Anyway, be that as it may.
That's true, yeah.
So that's interesting.
So, yes, I think, I guess it all comes down to, is this a response which is linked, is there kind of a meaningful connection between what is sought to be achieved and the power that's relied on and the outcome that's sought. So, you know, we can do things, but they're going to be limited and scrutinised by courts to see whether they're, you know, in line with what's sought to be achieved and proportionate.
And Stan, just on this, do you think the federation that exists within this country of states and territories with the Commonwealth overlaid on top helps or hinders people's understanding of how the law applies to them?
I think there's always been issues about, you know, consistency between state and Commonwealth laws and between states and territories. I think there can be a bit of confusion. I think clearly people in the border towns, Echuca, Moama, Albury, Wodonga in Victoria, New South Wales, they'll be struggling with this a little bit, and there'll be special measures like a permit system given to them. But I think, yeah, I think from, you know, at times people are confused about inconsistencies, and over a long period since Federation, there have been attempts to unify and make laws more consistent across the Federation.
If you just joined us, my guest this morning is Stan Winfred, who's an Associate Director of the Centre for Innovative Justice at RMIT University, and with him as well, Dr. Maria O'Sullivan, a Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Law at Monash University. And we're discussing here the kind of vexed questions around the rights of an individual in a democracy at a time of great public health concern and the rights of government to protect all of the community when perhaps, in some cases, those kind of decisions could impinge on the rights of the individual. And in light of what's happening in Victoria, we thought it was worthwhile having this discussion. Maria, do you think, given that there are now the processes in place for a judicial inquiry into how Victoria's quarantine breakages that came out of, I think, often hotels where people were being quarantined, and there's some inferences around security guards not observing correct hygiene and then taking that virus back into some of the affected hotspots. Do you think that kind of judicial inquiry will mean that we may see a tightening of movement across Victoria and perhaps beyond into the future?
Yes, it is quite possible. And if I could just talk more broadly, getting away from COVID, about things like outsourcing of governments, I think it's going to have a more widespread influence on the way governments operate. And my understanding is that one of the problems is that, you know, it wasn't done by the police. And I think that probably explains why the Premier of Victoria used police in response to the estates, because of this outsourcing problem. Anytime you outsource things like security, you're going to have accountability issues. And I mention that because that is a trend in government decision making. We can see that in the outsourcing of security to Nauru and Papua New Guinea, and that's had its problems. So I think getting away from COVID, that's going to have a systematic influence, at least in Victoria, about how we implement government programs and activities. But yes, as to the judicial inquiry, I'm not sure how long that's going to take, but yes, that again might influence the response that we have, whether we use the army and police versus private security companies.
And Stan, do you think that the way Victoria handles this situation will be of extreme interest to other states and territories? Will they be looking at the Victorian reactions and responses with a great deal of interest?
Yeah, look, I think so. I think the scope of this inquiry is to look at decisions and actions of government agencies, hotel operators and private contractors. It's going to look at communication between those groups, the contractual arrangements, information, guidance, training and equipment provided to staff, policies, protocols and procedures. I think across government, there's always been an issue in relation to the coordination of responses. And even in the Ruby Princess case, you could see that in relation to the different agencies involved and who was ultimately responsible for the decisions in relation to letting passengers off the boats. In Victoria, we had a Bushfire Royal Commission, which looked at the management of emergencies and which agency is responsible. And in fact, we had some new legislation to make it really clear about who was in charge of oversight in an emergency. So I think that's going to be a huge lesson for people. I think also, you know, findings and recommendations about preventing future occurrences will be really useful for looking at infection control and training and those sorts of things.
Well, while we're talking about infection control, given what's happening in Victoria and the concern that's been raised, you know, not only nationally, but I think globally over this, Maria, can you see a time legally where perhaps state governments, territories start to mandate the wearing of face masks across all parts of the country.
Yes, that is possible. And again, the discretions in the Public Health Acts in the state and territories are very wide. There's a section which basically says the minister or the chief health officer can make a direction that is reasonably necessary. And that term allows all sorts of things. It allows for mandatory testing. It allows for things like face masks, etc. Then you would have to look at how that's enforced. So, you know, if you're at a cafe and you take your mask off to have your coffee, you know, and you forget to put it on, are you going to be fined? And that, of course, is what we saw in the past months when people didn't really understand about social distancing and we had people being fined because they were eating kebabs in the park, etc. So if we were to implement that, again, going back to what law allows, it clearly allows that. But I think enforceability would have to be very carefully dealt with. The police would have to be trained as to what the guidelines required, and also there would be have to be an education program, I think, you know, advertisements on the television, etc., because that would be a very widespread enforcement mechanism.
There's so many issues to touch upon here. It's been a great discussion, but time is upon us, and I do thank you both very much for being on Life Matters with me today. It's been great.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks, Stan.
Stan Winford, Associate Director for the Centre for Innovative Justice at RMIT University, and Dr. Maria O'Sullivan, Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Law at Monash University. Keep your thoughts coming in as well.